It's time to head out on the front porch on KFRM. Grab your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation on the front porch.
Hi, this is Kyle Bauer, your host today on the front porch, and my guest is Doug Melville. He's the author of a book that just came out very recently. It's called The Invisible Generals. Well, what's so fascinating about it is the invisible generals that he talks about are members of his family. Now, maybe not by blood, but they are members of family. His adopted grandfather, or foster grandfather, was part of the Tuskegee Airmen and ended up being in several administrations. And the thing that's kind of fantastical about it is both him, or his grandfather, and his great-grandfather were black men. And so thus the title of the book, The Invisible Generals. It's just a fantastic story. Thank you, Doug, for being with me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
So, are you a writer by vocation?
No, I'm not a writer by vocation. I think, there's this thing that they have that everyone's a writer because they all have pens, but not everybody's an author.
All right.
So I think I would say I am a writer, as with all your listeners and everyone out there. And over the past several years, I've honed the craft of writing to become an author, but it's not something that I do as my day-to-day job or for a living, or that's not something I have been doing. But looking forward into the future, I did enjoy the process of authoring a title.
And where are you located right now? Where do you live?
I live in Geneva, Switzerland. I've been there for the last several years. As I talk to you today, I'm actually in Midtown Manhattan in New York City.
Oh, I was going to say, I just dialed a New York number, so I had no idea. I'm glad you're in the country. It's more simple for us. Your father was is Lawrence Melville. Is that right?
Yeah. So in the story of the Invisible Generals, my dad is Larry Melville. And he was Benjamin O. Davis Jr.'s oldest nephew. And when Ben Jr. and his wife were unable to have children, he raised my father as if it was his only son, similar to how his dad had raised him as his only son. So when I tell this story, it really is from a place of Ben Davis Jr., who is the son of the Invisible Generals, one of the two men. He really was the patriarch and center of our whole family. And, you know, if I didn't know the relationship with my dad, I would have thought it was his son.
Well, and that says something about Ben Jr. in itself, in that he took on somebody that and raised them as his son. Ben, though, was raised by a general, a black general in the United States Army, and, if you will, groomed for destiny.
Yeah, I think looking back at it, you know, Steve Jobs has that famous saying that he always would say, that you can't look at life connecting the dots forward, but you can backwards. And I think it's easy for me to tell this story from the future and look back at it. But the amazing part of this story is that at the time, it seemed like there was no hope that the story could realistically happen. You know, the United States was segregated. The United States military was 100% segregated. So you have a man who wanted to fight for his country, who wanted to go to West Point and got all the signatures and was rejected by President William McKinley and was told, we don't want to get in the habit of allowing blacks into West Point.
And this was Ben Sr.
That's Ben Sr. Uh-huh. Yes. So this is in the late 1800s, 1899 to be exact. Ben Sr. had gotten the necessary signature from a congressman or a senator. It was actually Senator Logan, and he had gotten that signature from Senator Logan because Ben Davis Sr.'s father, Louis Davis, worked for Senator Logan and also was the babysitter for Ulysses S. Grant's son. So because of the relationship that Louis Davis in the late 1800s had with the senator, he was able to get the signature for his son, who was Ben Davis Sr., to get into West Point. And when he was rejected due to race, he then left home and joined the Buffalo Soldiers in Wyoming. But the reason I say it like this is all he wanted to do was the American dream, get the signature to get into West Point, fight for the country, just like hundreds of other men, thousands over time, had been doing. But because of race and because of the military's policy of segregation, allowing a black to become an officer was seen as a road to nowhere because you were not allowed to command anybody white. So if whites didn't have to salute blacks and blacks couldn't command whites, why would the military promote a black who ultimately couldn't command anybody? So that was really the reason why blacks were not being allowed to enter West Point.
So when he went to be with the Buffalo Soldiers, he must have progressed through rank through that vein.
Yeah, so after he was rejected from West Point in 1899, he went out to join the Buffalo Soldiers, whose main task was to keep the Native Americans at bay out west. So even the assignment wasn't something that many of the Buffalo Soldiers, you know, ultimately didn't want to injure the Native Americans because the assignment in itself wasn't loved by all the men. But the fact of the matter was Ben Sr. met the only other black graduate of West Point at the time, whose name was Charles Young. And Charles Young said, you know, if you work hard and you train someone from the time that they're young, you can get someone into West Point as long as you train them from the time that they were young. So Ben Davis Sr. Became a great equestrian with the Buffalo Soldiers. And in 1901, the same president, which was President William McKinley, that had rejected his application into West Point, elevated him to officer and let him know that he saved him 2 years of his life by not having him attend West Point. And that was how Ben Davis Sr. became an officer in the United States Army. He then would go on to have three children, two daughters and a son, and his wife would die during childbirth, and he would become a single father. So here he is in the early 1900s. He is a single father. He is the only black officer in the United States military. He has one son, and he decides to take him for a ride in an airplane to go barnstorming. And his son comes down and goes, "Daddy, I want to be a pilot." And when he said this, he looked at his son and goes, "There's one way that you can become a pilot in the United States, and that is through graduating West Point. Because even though the United States is segregated, they could never say no to a West Point grad who graduates in the top third of his class." And this is when Ben Jr. was 12 years old.
Now, it was pretty fascinating as to how he got a congressman to sign his application.
So once he inspired his son, he trained his son to wake up at the same time every day, eat the same food, all of the different things that he would need to know in order to be successful. And now it was time for him to get the signature to allow his son to get into West Point. Well, at the time, in the early 30s, there was only one black congressperson in the whole United States of America, and he was living in Illinois. His name was Oscar DePriest. Well, Ben Davis Sr. had a home, and his family was situated in Washington, D.C. So Ben Sr. sold the family house and all of the family possessions to get enough money to relocate the whole family to Illinois to live in the district for 1 year of the only black congressman in the United States so he could obtain the signature necessary to get his son into West Point. Now, right there is a level of sacrifice people wouldn't do it today.
Well, I'm going to cut you off right there. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about Ben Jr.'s time at West Point, and it's fascinating in itself. We're talking to Doug Melville. He's the author of the book Invisible Generals. Join us after this break for more on the Front Porch. Welcome back to On the Front Porch. I'm visiting with Doug Melville today. He's the author of the book Invisible Generals, and they're members of his family. They're black generals that were in the military for most of the 1900s or the 20th century. When we went to a break, Ben Davis Jr. Was just getting a signature to get into West Point. Pick it up from there, Doug.
Yeah, so now Ben Jr. is accepted into West Point. They got the signature. He passed the exam, and his dad, Ben Sr., drops him off at the train in Illinois, in Chicago. And just like any father and son, he hugs his dad goodbye. His son says, "I'll miss you." He gets on the train. He arrives at West Point, and they were unaware that he was black. So they hold him in the commandant's office for some time while they tell him that they're going to prepare his room assignment. And when he gets his room assignment, he's actually at the end of the hallway in a converted janitor's closet. And he goes to bed that night scared. You know, he's 19 years old. He's the only person on campus with no roommate. He's in a converted room at the end of the hall. And then he wakes up the next day to footsteps of all his fellow cadets. And he thinks that he's not invited to the meeting because he's in a converted room and no one knocked on his door to let him know. So he rushes down to the meeting and he gets to the door and it's locked. And the meeting was in the sink, and it was an all-hands meeting of the cadets and the staff. And they said, "We accidentally let N-word into the campus. We are to treat him as if he's invisible and silence him until he drops out." So Ben hears this, calls his father. His father says, "Son, we've been training you for this moment. There's 13 million black Americans that are rooting for you. I'm going to need you to write the date on the wall and look at that date. And no matter what anybody does to you, you have to graduate from West Point." And that began 4 years of what I think is the greatest mental test that any young person has had to come through, with the result that came out of it, which was he went there for 4 years with no human interaction except in the classroom. So 50 weeks a year, he had to eat alone every day, three times a day, room alone, wasn't allowed to go into the buildings on campus because they segregated them, wasn't allowed to have a study partner. He had three classes that he didn't pass because nobody wanted to partner with him, CPR class, boxing class. So he went through all of this, and with 1 month left to go, they pull him back in the commandant's office, and they let him know that he is in the top third of the class, And although normal cadets would be able to pick what they want to do, in the if you graduate in the top third, you could select your assignment. And he said, I want to fly airplanes. But at the time, in 1936, it was illegal for blacks to fly airplanes or operate any heavy machinery in the United States Army. So they told him, if we would rather you just drop out, because you're never going to be in charge of anybody and you're never going to fly an airplane. And he said, that's fine. One day, you know, my time will come. And he graduates in 1936. And when he shakes his father's hand at graduation, they become the only two black officers in the United States military out of 335,000 men until the start of World War II.
So he took an assignment where? How did he learn how to fly? I mean, again, I saw the movie Red Tails, I can't remember how. Again, the movie was fascinating. We're going to go a different direction. When you saw the movie for the first time, it was different for you seeing it than for me seeing it.
Yeah, when I saw the movie Red Tails for the first time, and actually maybe what I can do right here, let me just connect the graduation from West Point. If I can connect the graduation sure. from West Point to Red Tails, just so we really can to understand when the movie came out, why I couldn't understand why they would change the names and not share the real story. So they graduate from West Point. Now the military has two black officers, and blacks are not allowed to be in charge of whites. So what do they do with these two men? They send them on the road for 4 years to train black college students in Army studies and ROTC. So remember, at this time, the college system was 100% segregated. So what they did was they went around to all the black colleges for 4 years, and they told these men, one day your day will come, keep your chin up, head up. And when FDR was looking to be reelected, he brought on the senior Ben Davis as an advisor to Negro policy to see how he could ensure he would get the black vote in the upcoming election. Because at the time, most black Americans were voting for Abraham Lincoln because Lincoln created the Republican Party. So Ben Sr. said, the only way you're going to, the best way that you're going to be able to get the black vote is to ensure that the United States Army, which was the biggest company in America, the largest employer, gave fair opportunities for blacks in the hardest roles. And that would begin with allowing blacks to be pilots. And FDR said, but who would lead that? And Ben Davis Sr. said, my son. And this is when Ben Davis Sr. goes down to Tuskegee, Alabama, and goes through flight training school. And after the training concluded, which was March 7th, he became America's first black pilot in the United States Army.
Sorry, what year is that?
It's early 40s.
Okay, before World War II.
Before World War II, okay. In the early 40s. So now they say, okay, we have this man, one black pilot. There was four other black pilots, and they were the first five graduates. And then they said, well, we want to build a whole squadron, but where will we get the men? And because Ben and his father had gone to all those campuses for 4 years, they put out the call, and that was the creation of the Tuskegee Airmen. 15,000 men and women who operated during World War II in a 100% segregated Air Force were created and led by 29-year-old Ben Davis Jr.
I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. It's just wild. And of course, a lot of it is obviously fate. But really, Ben Davis Sr. had a vision, and he and Ben Davis Jr. was willing to work the work to do it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing here when you think about fathers and sons, when you think about that time period. You know, we don't really talk about stories like this, but it's so powerful that a father would do this for his son with the unknown that the Army is segregated. Everyone is telling them this is not going to happen. This is impossible. There's nobody ahead of them. There's nobody looking out for them. And this father believes all this time that eventually the stakes will turn and it'll work out. And that is exactly what happened.
Now, you got to remind me, we have about 2 minutes in this segment. Tuskegee is Alabama, Mississippi. One air base dedicated just to the Black Flyers?
Yes. Yeah, so, and this is a very interesting part. It was one air base in Tuskegee, Alabama, Moulton Field, that trained all the men. But when they went over to start fighting in the war in 1944 was when they went over to Ramitelli, Italy, and they had a base over there, and that's where the Tuskegee Airmen were stationed during World War II for much of their time. The military was 100% segregated, so any mechanic that worked on a white pilot's plane was not allowed to work on a black pilot's plane. Any part that was on a white pilot's plane was not allowed to be used on a black pilot's plane, nor were the tools, nor were the instructions, nothing. 100% segregated. So when he gets over to the base in Ramitelli, Italy, Ben Davis Jr. realizes that some of the maps that he is getting do not have the base on it because the maps were segregated. So he tells the men before their longest flight, which was 4th of July weekend, 1944, I need you to paint all the tails of the planes red so people in America and the Allied forces will know that we are on their team.
We're going to go to a break. That is Doug Melville. He is the author of the book Invisible Generals. And right now we're in the middle of World War II with the Tuskegee Airmen. So join us after the break where we'll hear more of this fascinating story. Welcome back to On the Front Porch. I'm visiting with Doug Melville. He is a distant relative of two of the early black generals in the Army, and we've been talking about how they came to do that, and one of them ended up heading up the Tuskegee Airmen, which they ended up with red tails on their airplanes. But I have a story that ties that to that, because this was before they painted the tails red. A neighbor of mine was a navigator in a B-17 squadron over Italy his entire time there. And they were escorted many times by fighter planes. And there's nothing bigoted about this remark, but he said in his interview that when we looked out there and we saw it was the black boys that were escorting us, we knew everything was going to be okay. Isn't that weird how my neighbor and your grandfather were tied together in World War II?
Yeah, and you know, the thing about this process that's happened to me is people have contacted me and connected with me all over the United States about stories similar to this, because people knew who the Tuskegee Airmen were and they touched so many people. But because the stories weren't written down the same way, because after the war, many of the men exited the military because their contracts weren't permanent contracts. They were wartime contracts, that a lot of stories are out there that exist. And when I hear them, I just feel so good that people still to this day, of all the memories and all the things that you could pull up and recall, still have these thoughts in their minds, and they can still recall these tales.
Well, because of Lloyd's story, to me, when the Tuskegee Airmen movie, Red Tails, came out, I was the first one in. I just thought it was a fascinating story, and I thought they did a really good job from what I had, my research of portraying it, but it turns out I'm wrong. They didn't do a really good job.
Well, I think the movie did what it needed to do as relates to building awareness for the story and telling a story, which is what its purpose was. And I think when you, you know, at least on my journey, I just want to tell the other part of the story. It's a continuation of the story to say, now that you're aware that there were black fighter pilots in World War II, let's go one level deeper and share how this came to be. And those are the stories of the Invisible Generals.
But your, well, grandfather, if you will, was the main character in the book, but or I'm sorry, in the movie, but it never mentioned his name.
Yeah, so when I went to go see the movie Red Tails, and knowing some of the things that I'd shared with you already today, some of the things I shared with you I learned after the screening because I was so curious to research it. But when I went to the screening of Red Tails in the year 2011, the movie came out in the beginning of 2012. So there was a screening at the end of the year with the actors, with the cast, with the Tuskegee Airmen in attendance. And when Colonel Davis, who was played by Terrence Howard, the actor, entered the screen, I thought he was going to be addressed as such, but he was actually addressed as Colonel Bullard. And I looked around the theater to see if anybody had known that the name was not the actual name of the commander, but a fictitious name. And at the after party, I started asking people questions. I said no one in the theater realized it. And the producers of the movie kept saying to me, hey, Doug, you know, this is Hollywood. This is an amalgamation of many different characters. This isn't a documentary. And I went home to my dad and I said, Dad, this is unbelievable. And my dad said, if you think changing Ben's name in a movie is bad, wait till I tell you what we went through in real life. Let me sit you down and tell you the story of Ben and his dad who raised me. This is the story that we call the Invisible Generals because the military had us live like we were invisible, treated us as if we were invisible, yet we were part of the United States military in every single way. And that's when he shared with me some of the stories that that sparked me to research and write this book.
So your dad went to live with Ben Davis Jr. and his wife when he was 7?
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been after World War II?
Oh, no, my dad, nope, it was before World War II because my dad was actually born in 1933.
Oh, okay.
So it was before World War II. My dad just turned 90 years young. But it was before World War II, and many times when Ben was out on missions, you know, Ben's wife, Agatha, was there, and that was really the primary people who raised my dad was Ben and Agatha, and primarily Agatha because it was during the wartime and things of that nature. But it's important to understand that him being there as a first person allowed me to understand, really give context to the story, not just reading words and stats and facts, but just saying, hey, look at what this man went through as a boy and understanding segregation. And he would share with me all the different things he was learning, sitting in Ben's plane, wanting to be a pilot, wanting to fight for the country. And my dad didn't have great eye vision, so he was unable to fly airplanes at the time for the United States Army because you needed perfect vision in order to be a pilot. So my dad was a little bit more, you know, I love my dad so much. He was a little nerdier and a little bit more academic. So Ben had suggested that he goes into the field of law, because he said, I'm fighting for freedom through the military, through the Air Force. My dad fought through the Army. You can fight through the legal system. And that was when my dad went to Howard University. And he actually, you know, during that time, Thurgood Marshall, who was the first Black Supreme Court justice, would go to Howard University to work with the students to role play and things of that nature. And my dad was part of that group. So he actually came up in the law field in an amazing way, but he was unable to fly planes. But it was because of Ben's, you know, teachings, his discipline. So it was important for me when I was born to have that same understanding. And when I found out these stories, there was nothing I could do that was more important than writing them down to write this book.
Now, Ben's career, though, was storied, and after World War II, he was instrumental in all kinds of things, even a lot of non-military things.
Yeah, so as it ended up happening, when Ben left the United States military, Ben Davis Jr. left the United States military in 1970, he went on to work for various roles within the Department of Transportation, and he led the creation of the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. He led the creation of the United States Air Marshal Program to keep the skies safe and the training of 4,000 officers. He led the creation of airport security, commercial airport security, which was only at two airports in the United States at that time. He also led the creation of the Flying Thunderbirds, which was a troop that would go around and entertain people with their flying skills. He also was the person that changed the policy at the United States Air Force Academy to allow women to be cadets and build an equal amount of bathrooms for men and women on campus. So he did so much more for the country beyond just fighting for the country physically and commanding troops, but also for a lot of the practices and policies that we still use today that we don't know who created them. And until I started researching them, even I didn't know.
Even though he was invisible to the public, obviously a number of presidents realized the value of his counsel, because all those things didn't happen under one presidency.
No, the family had worked under 13 presidents total, but eight presidents they worked with. They worked, Ben Jr. worked with President Carter to pass the speed limit, President Nixon in the 70s to create the Air Marshal Program and commercial security, worked under LBJ, John F. Kennedy, FDR. Ben Davis Sr. worked under Truman. You know, remember when I shared the William McKinley story, even back to Ulysses S. Grant, you know, Ben Davis Sr.'s grandfather was on the buggy with Ulysses S. Grant during Grant's second presidential inauguration. It was Grant, it was Lewis Davis, and it was Ulysses S. Grant's son on Lewis Davis's knee as they were going down Pennsylvania Avenue and during the second presidential inauguration.
Well, that is Doug Melville. He is the author of Invisible Generals. The story is just so fantastical. You couldn't make it up, and yet it's 100% true about his family. And growing up, he didn't necessarily know it till he went into researching it. So we're going to talk about that just a bit in the last segment of how we all have a responsibility to talk to the older people in our family and find out the stories. Join us after this break for more On the Front Porch. Welcome back to On the Front Porch. I think you're probably as fascinated as I am with Doug Melville and his story of his family and the book he wrote, The Invisible Generals, and how his family has, I'll say quietly, served and crafted the country in many different ways. When we went to the break, we just talked about Ben Davis Jr. and his work with Carter and Nixon and LBJ. At some point, the military had to acknowledge how great a person that had gone through West Point.
Yeah, and so what ended up happening is after 10 years of lobbying by Senator John McCain, in the year 1998, Bill Clinton elevated Ben Davis Jr. into the rank of four-star general. So he was denied his fourth star under LBJ in 1960s. So everyone around thought he should have gotten the fourth star. It was obvious based on his accomplishments. But during that time period, LBJ had stated that he had already put Thurgood Marshall in the Supreme Court, and he already had passed Martin Luther King's civil rights agenda. So there was no more political capital for him to gain by promoting Ben to four stars. So he was asked to retire. So in 1970, he retired as a three-star general. Cut to all the things he accomplished in the Department of Transportation. Now we are in the year 1998, and our whole family is invited to the White House grounds for the promotion ceremony of Benjamin O. Davis Jr. to the rank of full four-star general. And at that ceremony, before we could get the fourth star, we had to sign a piece of paper that stated that we would not get any financial gain for the fourth star. And Agatha Davis, who was Ben Davis's wife for over 60 years, was so furious that the United States would elevate us to four-star general status only under the condition that we would not get 31 years of compensation going backwards, nor would we get any compensation for the time accrued going forward, which ended up being 4 years. So 35 years of pay would have to be foregone in order for us to get the star. And his wife of 60 years refused to go to the ceremony and told Ben not to get the fourth star. And Ben said, you know, I promised my father when I was a child that I would be a full four-star general. It was our dream together. And on that day, tomorrow, I'm going to go to the White House and I'm going to receive that honor. And on December 9th, which was 25 years ago this month, Ben Davis Jr. became a four-star general.
Wow. That is just amazing. I don't even know what to say. So it's just so great that you realized in time that you could gather this story, or a lot of these stories would go completely unrecognized.
Exactly. And that was the stories going unrecognized was something that I was going to do everything in my power to try to get them to be seen. And in the year 2015, I had set a Google alert after watching the movie Red Tails for the names Benjamin O. Davis Jr. and Sr. and said, you know, one day someone is going to find this story, or someone's going to hear this story. So let me set a Google alert, and whoever else hears or finds this story, I'm going to contact them to let them know what I know. And the Google alert didn't go off 2012, 2013, 2014. And in 2015, it goes off, and it was West Point. And West Point was going to name a barrack, their biggest, largest barracks, was going to be named after their greatest graduate. And there was three names up for consideration: William Westmoreland, Norman Schwarzkopf, and Benjamin O. Davis Jr. And when we had the meeting, some of the people said, well, you know, Ben Davis Jr. didn't get his fourth star in active duty. He got it when he was retired. So I don't think he's as strong of a candidate as the other two men who got their fourth star in active duty. And I then shared with them the story that I shared with you today on this radio show, and they decided that Ben Davis Jr. would be the recipient of the honor to have the largest, most expensive building, barracks in the history of West Point named after him. And in 2017, we cut the ribbon on the Davis Barracks. In 2019, the United States Air Force Academy renamed their airport and airfield, and the center of campus is called the Davis Airfield, was dedicated and renamed after him. And my learning of this was everybody in there has a story. And most families, particularly that are still led or inspired by someone who fought in World War II or someone who is older in age, these stories are incredible. But many of these men are in the silent generation. People don't share. There's people on your couches that have great stories. Everybody's looking forward. Everybody's paying attention to the kids' stories, your stories, the stories of celebrities, a story you read on Instagram. But the greatest stories in America are sitting on our couches and are being held by the older people in our household, and no one's talking to them. No one is asking them what happened. No one is taking their stories and then researching them and going into detail and saying, who are the people that are in my family and what did they do? The first chapter of my book is called Generational Collateral. And if there's one exercise that I would like everybody on this broadcast to do, is take an understanding and a checklist of all of the things that the people in your family did before you were born to position you to be in the place that you are today. Did they relocate? Did they have a certain network of people? Do they have a skill set that we just never tried, but maybe inherently could be in our DNA? We don't even know what the people before us did for us. And for me, understanding this story made me much more appreciative of my family and what they did. And I think that's the part of the journey that we are still writing today. And I encourage all your listeners to write for their own families, because the greatest stories in America are right there on the couch and just no one's talking because it's the silent generation.
I've done a number of interviews with veterans, and their families have told me regularly that they didn't know any of those things about, usually it's father. It comes out is, how come they told you? And it says, because I asked. You just have to ask a lot of times, and I was curious enough to ask. So I think everybody would be surprised if you just ask how people would tell you.
Just asking. Isn't it amazing?
Your book came out in October of...
November 7th. So just about a month ago.
Where is the easiest place to get it?
The book has been doing so great, and we've been getting so much support from all over the United States. And you can pick up the book at your local Barnes & Noble, local bookstore, independent bookstore, audiobook, Amazon, wherever books are sold. And the thing is, I'm happy to come in and, you know, talk to your company or sit down at your VFW or go to your Veteran Affairs next meeting or facility and tell the story, because we have to use stories to keep people going and keep inspiring.
Now, I'm sorry, at the very beginning, you said you live in Zurich, is that right?
Geneva, Switzerland.
Geneva, okay. So what do you do in Geneva?
I'm a diversity executive, so I work with companies to ensure equity and diversity across our policies and procedures to ensure that the companies that we are all part of and we all support around the world are equitable and fair and continue to evolve as companies should.
Well, that is Doug Melville. He is the author of A Family History, more or less, Invisible Generals, about his great-grandfather, his grandfather, and the story of how they were black men in the military over a time when segregation was the norm in our military. Please pick up the book, Invisible Generals. This is Kyle Bauer. That has been Doug Melville, and this is On the Front Porch.